आकुतिम
आकुतिम
रुचये
रुचये
प्रादा
अपि
भ्रातृमती विपह पुत्रिका धर्मम् आश्रित्य शतरूपा अनुमोदितः आकुतिम् आकुतिम् रुचये प्रादात् अपि भ्रातृमतीं नृपः पुत्रिका धर्ममाश्रित्य शतरूपानुमोदितः आकुतिं रुचये
प्रादात्
अपि भ्रातृमतीं नृपः पुत्रिका धर्ममाश्रित्य शतरूपानुमोदितः आकुतिम् आकुति रुचये अंटू द ग्रेट सेज रुचि प्रादात् हैंडेड ओवर अपि ऑल्दो भ्रातृमतीं daughter having a brother nripah
the king
putrika
get the resultant son
dharmam
religious rites
ashritya
taking shelter
Shatarupa by the wife of Swayambhuva Manu.
Anumoditaha
being sanctioned. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation: Akuti had two brothers, but in spite of her brothers, King Swayambhuva Manu handed her over to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of her be returned to Manu as his son. This he did in consultation with his wife Shatarupa. Purport. Sometimes a sonless person offers his daughter to a husband on the condition that his grandson be returned to him to be adopted as his son and inherit his property. This is called putrika dharma, which means that by execution of religious rituals, one gets a son, although one is sonless by one's own wife. But here we see extraordinary behavior in Manu, for in spite of his having two sons, he handed over his first daughter to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of his daughter be returned to him as his son. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments in this connection that King Manu knew that the Supreme Personality of Godhead would take birth in the womb of Akuti. Therefore, in spite of having two sons, he wanted the particular son born of Akuti because he was ambitious to have the Supreme Personality of Godhead appear as his son and grandson. Manu is the lawgiver of mankind, and since he personally executed the putrika dharma, we may accept that such a system may be adopted by mankind also. Thus, even though one has a son, if he wants to have a particular son from one's daughter, one may give one's daughter in charity on that condition. That is the opinion of Srila Jiva Goswami. Kindly repeat the translation. Akuti had two brothers.
Akuti had two brothers.
But in spite of her brothers, King Swayambhuva Manu
handed her over
to Prajapati Ruchi,
on the condition
that the son born of her,
be returned to Manu
as his son.
This he did.
In consultation with his wife,
Shatarupa.
Om Jnanati Virandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Nilitam Yevatasmai Shri Guravedamaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthaputam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna. The Vedic scriptures consist of a variety of scriptures. They are meant for our spiritual advancement, ultimately, so that we can become Krishna conscious and go back to Godhead. However, going back to Godhead is not such a simple matter. It needs a lot of perseverance lifelong. It needs perfect guidance. It needs perfect following of certain rules and regulations, like chanting the holy names, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, and so on. But that's not enough. From an absolute point of view, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, chanting the holy names, etc., are enough. But since we as practitioners are not on the absolute platform, we do need some supportive social arrangements and norms so we can lead our life in a way that will facilitate our spiritual progress. So a lot of scriptures in the house of the Vedas, so to speak, give us information about how our society should be organized and how we should live our day-to-day existence. What kind of rules and norms should we have for every little thing in our life? The duties within every ashram, for example, the Varnashrama Dharma is exactly just that. The Varnashrama Dharma indicates how one should live within the four varnas and four ashramas. The social and spiritual organization of society is mentioned there. And as part of that, we have what are called the Dharma Shastras. The Dharma Shastras are those scriptures that speak about the ordinary laws of Dharma. You see, Dharma is of various levels. There is ordinary dharma for day-to-day activity of interactions with others and how we live our life. And there is the ultimate dharma, our spiritual dharma, which is Krishna consciousness, Sanatana Dharma. The ultimate dharma, which is Krishna consciousness, is one for everyone. It is the ultimate thing. Whatever we may be in our material life, in terms of our psychophysical condition, we all have that one goal, which is to become Krishna conscious. And all these other goals that are these systems that we have in the scriptures are meant for us to be able to ultimately achieve that goal. So these dharma shastras give different rules and regulations for different sections of people, and particularly for those who are in household life. Then there's the rules about politics, about how a king should function, what kind of administration he should have, what kind of punishments he should give to criminals, and what kinds of sins are incurred for certain kinds of activities, and what are pious activities, and how should a householder live, what are the duties of the husband, the wife, what happens after death, and the different rituals and the norms for procreation. And in this case, in this verse, we see a certain norm that is in connection with adoption of children. Now, adoption is something very commonly known today, and it has been since the dawn of history, so to speak. But this is a very exceptional case of adoption that is mentioned here. So in the Vedic scriptures, we are going to see a wide variety of situations. And it's not always easy deciphering the proper dharmic thing to do in a given situation may not always be easy. That is why the kings always had wise ministers and brahmanas to advise him. Because the ways of dharma are very subtle and often very complex. We do not often realize what should be done in a particular situation, because there are conflicting laws, apparently conflicting dharmas. There's one law that says we should do this, but there's another law that says one should do the opposite in that particular situation. So then there is a consideration of higher dharmas and lower dharmas on that platform to decide. We see, for example, that Srila Prabhupada, who is the best example of the perfectly wise man in the modern age, he adjusted, so to speak, many of the lower dharmas for the sake of the higher dharmas. When he went to America in 1965, started ISKCON in 1966, there were many things that he had to adjust. But he did that for the sake of the ultimate dharma, which is Krishna consciousness. That doesn't mean, of course, that we should whimsically try to do away with dharmic laws. But we do need to adjust according to time, place and circumstance. On one hand, we need fidelity and chastity to the versions of our scriptures. And even the Dharma Shastra is as far as possible, we can try to implement them. But naturally, it is not possible to follow them in their entirety. It is not possible to follow the Varnashrama Dharma 100%. It is impossible, Srila Prabhupada said, in this age of Kali. So we have what we call the Daivi Varnashrama system, where we adopt from the Varnashrama system those elements that are helpful for the execution of our Krishna conscious activities. Understanding that Krishna consciousness is the topmost dharma. So this is Daivi Varnashrama. The dharma we follow is called Bhagavata Dharma. Bhagavata Dharma means pure Krishna consciousness, developing pure love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But because the supportive thing is required, we are not like Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, Krishna Das, Kaviraj Goswami, Haridas Thakur, who can simply just chant all day, living in Vrindavan or living in Mayapur. We have so many other needs and we have situations that require some guidance. So we take some elements from the Varnashrama Dharma. This is precisely what Daivi Varnashrama Dharma is all about. I'm sure we've all heard the phrase Daivi Varnashrama Dharma. So this is what it means. So on one hand, we cannot whimsically reject even the Dharma Shastras. And on the other hand, we also cannot follow everything that is there in the Dharma Shastras in this modern day and age. So we need the guidance and instructions of Acharyas like Srila Prabhupada to tell us what to do and what not to do. And in this connection, we have the example of what's called Putrika Dharma. Svayambhuva Manu is the Manu, the foremost human being. It is from the word Manu that the word man comes. Ultimately, as you know, Sanskrit was the original language and the Vedic culture was the original culture of the world. So from Manu, all humans are descendants of Manu. So from Manu comes man. In fact, even the Sanskrit word Manushya, which means human, comes from Manu. Those who are born of Manu. So the original man is Manu. I don't know, I haven't done such a good deep study of the Bible, but perhaps the equivalent of Adam and Eve, I don't know. Maybe someone who's a scholar in Christianity and Krishna consciousness can do a little research on this. So anyway, so Manu is the foremost of human beings, or the progenitor, original progenitor of humans. And he is the son of Brahma. Very exalted position and very exalted father to have, the creator of the world, Brahma. He has 5 children, 3 daughters and 2 sons. In the previous verse we heard that his daughters were Akuti, Devahuti and Prasuti. And about Devahuti, there's been discussion in the previous canto at length, and especially about her conversation with her son Kapila. Kapila Dev is the incarnation of the Lord. About Prasuti, we get information later on. And in this verse, we're speaking about Akuti. Now, Svayambhuva Manu also has 2 sons, Priyavrat and Uttanapad. And the peculiar thing in this verse, as Srila Prabhupada mentions in the purport, is that when he handed over his daughter Akuti to Prajapati Ruchi in marriage, he did so on the condition that the son born of the 2 of them would be given back to him and he would adopt that child as his son. So the grandson would become his son by adoption. And this system is called Putrika Dharma. Even though he had 2 sons. Now normally the Putrika Dharma is adopted when a person is sonless. But in this case, he already had 2 sons. And the reason is also mentioned here in the purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that the reason Svayambhuva Manu did this was because he knew that the Supreme Lord would be born to Akuti and Prajapati Ruchi, and his name would be Yajna, and he would be an incarnation of the Lord. So therefore he wanted that grandson to come back to him as his son. And incidentally, the last line of this verse is important. This he did in consultation with his wife Shatarupa. An instruction to all Grihasthas, whatever you do, consult with your wife before you do it. The wise thing to do. So coming back to Putrika Dharma, the word Putrika refers to a daughter. Sometimes we see in the Dharma Shastras, in the Vedic culture, that when a person did not have a son, but he had a daughter, he would consider the daughter to be a son, and he would appoint her as a son, even though she was a daughter. And she would thus be empowered to perform his funeral rites. Generally, the word son in Sanskrit is called putra. The word putra indicates he who will deliver the father and the mother and the ancestors from the hell named put. Putrayate narakat iti putraha. So, by performing the Shraddha ceremony and so on, one delivers one's ancestors. Now, generally, traditionally, this has been reserved for the sons to do. But where there is a problem, the father may appoint the daughter and say, now you have the right to do this. So she will then perform the funeral rites, and she will also get the inheritance rights and everything like that. Because otherwise what happens is that, used to happen rather, the daughter would go to another family and she would inherit then the property in her husband's family's side. But in this case, she would get the property, her son would then get the property from her father's side. So these adjustments were made. Not that these are the most important things in human life, but they do matter when cases of adoption come up. So the son of the Putrika is called the Putrika Putra. So this system of Putrika Putra was called Putrika Dharma, as this the verse itself says, and Srila Prabhupada also mentions this in the purport. He says, this is called Putrika Dharma, which means that by execution of religious rituals, one gets a son, although one is sonless by one's own wife. There are several examples of Putrika Dharma in the scriptures. One example is of Vasudev, who married the daughter of the king of Kashi. And the king of Kashi said the marriage can happen only according to the principles of Putrika Dharma. So Vasudev agreed. And then the son born of that became the king of Kashi. However, the most famous example that I can think of, there may be others, I don't know, is of Babru Vahana, the son of Arjuna, in the Mahabharata, the most famous case of Putrika Dharma. So I'll spend a few minutes telling some stories now. Immediately everyone perks up, nice stories, nice. Otherwise philosophy and this and that gets a little boring sometimes. You know, Arjuna had four wives. In Vedic culture, it was accepted thing to do, especially for the Kshatriyas, the kings. And, of course, one was Draupadi, and he had a son from her who was called, anyone knows? What was Arjuna's son from Draupadi? No. Shrutakirti. Arjuna's son from Draupadi was Shrutakirti. Second was Subhadra. And the son from Subhadra was? Abhimanyu. The third was Ulupi. She was a Naga princess from the Naga kingdom. And Arjuna met her at Haridwar when he was on exile. I'll mention about the exile in a few moments. He married her, and son from her was called? Anyone quiz? Iravan. And then finally, his fourth wife was Chitrangada, who was a princess of Manipur. Manipur is a small state in northeastern India, which has a very strong Vaishnava culture. And She was a princess of that kingdom. And how Arjuna met her is interesting. You see, when Arjuna won the hand of Draupadi in the Swayamvara ceremony, he won a competition in which the arrow had to be shot in the eye of a fish who was rotating, and you had to look into the reflection and shoot. So we all know that story. So he won the hand of Panchali, or Draupadi, in marriage. And ultimately it turned out, time doesn't permit us to tell the whole story, that all the five Pandavas became the husbands of Draupadi. A very, very unusual situation, where the reverse happened. Now Draupadi had five husbands, because Kunti unwittingly had said, whatever you have, you share amongst all the brothers, because that was the principle. So now you have five husbands and one wife, so what do you do? So on the advice of Narada Muni, the following arrangement was made, that Draupadi would spend 1 year with each husband. And in the time in that 1 year, when she was with one husband, none of the others would be with her or enter into the room when the two of them were together. And if any of the brothers did that, then they would go into exile for, I think it was 12 years or something. So one time what happened is, it was a year in which Draupadi was with Yudhishthir Maharaj. And there was some emergency that came up. A brahmana came asking for protection for his cows from some dacoits. And he pleaded for help to Arjuna. Arjuna, being a kshatriya, had to oblige. That was his dharma. But his Gandiva bow was in the same room where Yudhishthir Maharaj was with Draupadi. So now what to do? Now again, see, this is one of those situations where the dharma is conflict. You have to take a choice. So either way, you're going to be in trouble. Right? So what do you do now? If he goes inside, then he breaks a vow they have taken. He has given his word. All the brothers have agreed. It's a sacred agreement. He'll be violating his word. And on the other hand, if he doesn't go in, he can't get his weapons. And he can't defend the cows and the brahmanas. And that's abdication of duty, and that's very wrong. So then he hesitated, he thought for a few moments, and then he decided, well, if I go in, what's going to happen is that I'll have to go in exile for 12 years. Better I suffer than I let the brahmana and the cow suffer. So he went inside and grabbed the Gandiva bow and the arrows, and then he went out, he subdued those decoys, rescued the cows, gave them back to his the brahmana. Brahmana was happy, and then he came back to King Yudhishthir to apologize and explain the circumstances under which he had entered the room at that time. And he said to his brother and to Draupadi, in accordance with the vows that we have taken, I will go in exile for 12 years. So both Yudhishthir and Draupadi were aghast. They said, no, this was an emergency. It wasn't a normal situation. He didn't come here just whimsically. But Arjuna said, a vow is a vow, a word is a word. And no matter what the compulsion, I have broken my word, and therefore I must go into exile. They all tried to convince him, but he wouldn't budge. So he left for exile. And the first place he went to from there, from Hastinapur or Indraprastha, was Haridwar, up north in the Himalayas. The gateway to Hari. Dwar means door, and Hari is Krishna. So the foothills of the Himalayas, you have Haridwar, a very famous holy place. And it was there that he met Ulupi. He married her there, and then Iravan was conceived. And then he moved on to other parts of India. He came and he went all the way to the northeast. And in the northeastern part, in the Manipur region, he met this beautiful princess, Chitrangada. So naturally, he was attracted to her and they got married. He wanted to marry her. So he approached her father, the king of Manipur. The king of Manipur said, "You are one of the great Pandavas. It would be a matter of great joy and honor for me to hand my daughter over to you in marriage. But there's one problem. The problem is that we have a custom here, that this is a matrilineal society here, at least in this case. The son of my daughter must inherit my kingdom. He must become the king. So are you prepared for that?" So Arjuna said, "Yes. After I marry your daughter and have children from her, I will neither take away your daughter nor her children. I will let them remain behind in Manipur." So the marriage was solemnized and Arjuna stayed there for some time and the son was conceived. He was born later and his name was Babru Vahana. Babru Vahana was a very powerful warrior. After all, he was the son of Arjuna. And Arjuna had gone back, so he never saw Babru Vahana. And meanwhile, years passed. Babru Vahana grew up to be a fine young man, a warrior. And there in Hastinapur, you know, everything changed a lot. The battle of Kurukshetra was over. The Kauravas had been defeated. The Pandavas had emerged victorious. King Yudhishthir Maharaj had ascended the throne. And sometime after that, he wanted to perform the Ashwamedha Yajna, the horse sacrifice. And for the horse sacrifice, the system is that a horse is let loose and the horse wanders where it wills. And into whichever kingdom the horse wanders, then the king of that land has two choices. Either to submit to the owner of that horse and say, "I submit to Yudhishthir Maharaj," or to apprehend the horse and say, "I will fight." So most of the kings were very friendly to the Pandavas and they accepted the suzerainty of King Yudhishthir. However, when the horse came all the way into the northeastern part of Manipur, the king of Manipur, who is now Babru Vahana, came forward and he realized that this was his father, Arjuna. So he had two choices, either to submit to his father, which was not a Kshatriya thing to do, because when somebody comes in an aggressive spirit, you have to fight as a Kshatriya. Or the other thing was, he had to fight his father, in which case one of them would get killed. So that was also not a good thing to do. Again, one of those things where your dharmas conflict. Yes? So Babru Vahana chose the former. He said, "I will not fight with my father." So he came in front of his father and said, "I submit to you." And Arjuna, being a Kshatriya, taunted his son, "What kind of a Kshatriya are you? Shame on you. You should fight." And he taunted him, and then Babru Vahana fought. And they fought ferociously. And it so happened that Babru Vahana actually made Arjuna unconscious, and it is said that he actually killed him. And in the meanwhile, his stepmother, Ulupi, because after that he was repenting like anything, Babru Vahana, so Ulupi came to his aid. And she said, "I have this particular gem, Naga gem, Naga money, and you can use this to revive Arjuna." And Krishna was present. So with Krishna's assistance, mercy, And with the help of that gem, Arjuna was revived. Actually, Babruvahana first of all defeated Arjuna's army, because Arjuna didn't want to fight a boy. He wanted to fight an equal. But Babruvahana, who was a strapping young lad at that time, he defeated the army. He defeated Bhima. He defeated and killed the son of Karna, Vrishtaketu, I think his name was. And that's when Arjuna felt obliged to come into the battle. And then he was defeated. So then with the help of Krishna and that gem, Arjuna was revived. And so was Vrishtaketu. Because when Arjuna heard that Vrishtaketu has died, he was saying he felt responsible for Vrishtaketu's death. So he also didn't want to live any longer. But Vrishtaketu was also revived. So then Arjuna was very proud of his son. He embraced him. And then he went back. In one of the Mahabharatas, the Jaimini Mahabharata, the normal Mahabharata is the Vaishampayana Mahabharata. The sage Vyasa has his disciple Vaishampayana who speaks to Janamejaya, the king of Parikshit. And that's the normal Mahabharata. But there's another Mahabharata called the Jaimini Mahabharata, from which the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's a connection there of Sanatana Goswami. So in any case, in the Jaimini Mahabharata it is said that Ulupi actually urged Babruvahana to attack the Naga kingdom and forcefully take away that gem from them, which Babruvahana did, and then he was able to revive Arjuna. So why did that happen? Why did Arjuna have to be defeated and killed by Babruvahana? It's mentioned in one place that when the battle of Kurukshetra was being fought, Arjuna used Shikhandi as a shield to fight against Bhishma. Shikhandi used to be Amba in the previous life, and she had been spurned by Bhishma. So she vowed revenge, and she said, "I'll be reborn again to be the cause of your death." So she was reborn as Shikhandi, and Bhishma had already told Arjuna that the only way you can kill me is, you know, when you have one of the ways is when there's a lady. I can't fight with a lady. Or you put them in front and I'll drop my weapons. I cannot fight. That's one of my principles of warfare. So otherwise he was undefeatable. So when he placed Shikhandi in front, Bhishma refused to fight, and that's where he got the opportunity. So Bhishma, as you know, was one of the Vasus who had been cursed to be born on earth. He was a Dyu. You remember your Mahabharata stories, yes? So when Bhishma was killed in this fashion, his brothers in the heavenly kingdom, the other Vasus, were not happy. So they cursed Arjuna. "You have killed our brother unjustly. Therefore we curse you to be killed by your own son." And therefore Arjuna was killed by Babruvahana. And Srila Prabhupada mentioned Babruvahana on a couple of occasions. When he had gone to, he was talking to the devotees from Manipur, which is like a Vaishnava community actually. He said that you are all descendants of Babruvahana, the great devotee of Krishna. And therefore you must make Manipur as a Vaishnava state. He said that. And then he also said that the royal families of Manipur and Tripura are descendants of Babruvahana, the son of Arjuna. So this is one famous case of the Putrika Dharma. Babruvahana was the Putrika Putra for the king of Manipur. That Vaishnava culture is still very, very strong in this day and age. Now the adoption in this age is therefore a valid way. if some grihastha doesn't have a child and wants to adopt another child, then that is an acceptable form, shastrically sanctioned form of having a child. However, grihasthas who do go for adoption should be aware of the risks involved, because generally adoption is done of children who of unknown parentage. So you don't know what kind of karmas they bring into their life and what kind of karmas they will bring into your life. So it's a risk. In this case, in the case of Putrika Dharma, it is well known. Because it's your own daughter. You know your daughter, you know her husband, you know the family, you know their, you know, mentalities. So even when adoption is done, it's advisable it's done from children of devotees, if possible. But usually devotees wouldn't be eager to hand over the children. I know of situations where an agreement was made. There was a devotee couple who wanted children. They weren't getting any children. And they entered into some kind of an agreement, verbal agreement, with another devotee couple who were having a child and were not in a position to have that child and maintain the child. So they agreed that once the child is born, you know, we'll hand over the child to you and you adopt the child. But once the child was born, the mother refused to hand over the child. So these are some of the issues that happen in adoption. Some devotees have also adopted children of unknown parentage, and perhaps they're doing all right. So adoption as a means is all right, and for those who don't get children, despite all of that, just accept Krishna as your child and go on with life. Don't worry, don't be in anxiety about it. Just ultimately our goal is not to have children. Our goal is to become pure devotees of Krishna. But yes, when there is grihastha ashram, it's preferable there are children. Because that is the grihastha dharma. So we'll stop here and we'll have some questions if time permits. Yes, Bhakta Prabhu, Hare Krishna.
Can you comment, in today's society we have surrogate mothers, they have one children, and also we have in vitro fertilization. What is the Vedic point of view on the current modern means of raising or getting a child?
Okay, Bhakta Prabhu's question is, what is our view on surrogate motherhood and on in vitro fertilization, IVF? Modern day has a science of entering into territories they shouldn't be entering into. Try to play God in many situations. And many of these things are in grey areas. Biomedical ethics for us is a very sensitive, touchy topic, because as an institution we don't have any stated policies on these things. But I can just try to offer some personal opinion. As far as in vitro fertilization is concerned, what is in vitro fertilization? In vitro fertilization is when the fertilization of the sperm and the ovum happens outside the mother's womb. That's called, although the word in vitro, actually it is out, outside the womb. In vitro means like in a test tube or something like that. Therefore you had the test tube baby, if you remember, many years ago. So in vitro fertilization means that instead of the fertilization of the sperm and ovum happening inside the mother's womb, it happens externally, artificially, in a test tube or something like that. Now the principle of it is all right, because we see many instances of that in the Vedic scriptures. Drona was a case of IVF. He was born outside in a drona. Drona is a little cup. Therefore he's called Drona. His name became Drona because of that. So there are numerous such instances. However, I'm not a doctor, and I stand corrected if anybody is a doctor here, especially a gynecologist. But the way the IVF is done is that they take many ovum from the mother, ova, and they fertilize each and every one of them, and they finally select only one of them. So what happens is that the eggs, and the fertilized eggs are then destroyed. That we cannot accept. If they take only one, fertilize that outside, then I think we have no objection to that. But if they take more than one and they destroy the others, that's where we would have objection. And the reason they take many is to increase the likelihood of success. Because if they do just one, it may not succeed. And they go through such an elaborate process and so on. At the end of it, if it not doesn't succeed, then it's disappointing. So they don't want to take chances. Still, they don't succeed in all cases. But in that sense, this is my view from whatever I have understood. But if somebody has a better understanding, who understands gynecology, I'm not a medical person, as I said, but this is my understanding of the situation. As far as surrogate motherhood is concerned, well, I suppose what that means is that a lady offers a womb. Neither the ovum nor is not hers. The ovum is not hers, right? Is that what it's all about? And there's some fertilized egg which is implanted into her womb. She basically just rents out her womb. And then when the child is born, then the child goes back to the biological parents. Isn't that what it is? I beg your pardon?
It can also be that the surrogate mother's egg is utilized. If the wife of the person is sterile, then they can use...
Right, okay. So a second possibility is when the egg of the lady who is not the wife of that man is used to fertilize the sperm. Well, you see, in that case, the couple that is having the child must be aware that the child is not their child, because the ovum comes from another lady. So that the man's wife must understand that. And if she's okay with that, then that's another thing. Yes? Because neither is it her ovum, neither does she bear the child in her womb. So for her, it's just like adoption. It's like having a stepchild. In that sense. So if she's okay with that, then... But then again, there is question of karma of the other lady, and you know, so these are all grey areas. I think sooner or later, as a movement, we should start having stands, the cloning and, you know, modern medical sciences, the biogenetic engineering and everything, they come up with all sorts of things which are very, dicey. Very difficult to say in some cases. I think better we should just stick to the normal way and just go according to nature, you know, just not tamper too much with the laws of nature, not try to play God too much. There's no limit to how these biological sciences will go in the future, you see. I read an article in one of these famous, I think it was Time magazine, somewhere, where it said that there are serious efforts going on to see how men can become pregnant and what men can actually bear children. So men can actually bear. So some people are working towards that. It may be a while. If at all that's possible for making something. It's very complicated, this whole thing. You know, so there's no limit to where these things will go. And it's just completely turning the whole natural system topsy-turvy. So I would view all these things with a lot of trepidation, with a lot of caution. And each of these cases, a new innovation, so to speak, will have to be seen on merits. But I would see all of them with some caution, because there's so much of tampering going on, genetic tampering and playing God, so to speak. So that's the general answer that I can give. Hare Krishna. Aniruddha Prabhu, Hare Krishna. Too much endeavor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we've already got systems.
Yes.
Already arranged it.
Yes. Aniruddha Prabhu's point is, if it's not happening naturally, just accept it as Krishna's arrangement. Sometimes what happens is if the parents are too keen, it's so strong, the desire to have a child. It happens sometimes, so then what to do? That is the situation. They're not able to accept that they can't have a child and not having a child. So, in which case, well, what are the options? These are the options, and each of these options is fraught with some risk. Even having your own child is fraught with risk. You don't know what that child is going to be when he or she grows up. Therefore, the principle of Garbhadhana Samskar and all of that, which is so important for us. Yeah. Yes.
In the Prabhupada, they mentioned that Swayambhu Manu was ambitious to have a son as Supreme Personality of Godhead, as well as son-in-law. So, in a way, it looks like Swayambhu Manu is depriving his own daughter of the Vatsalya of Godhead.
Okay, the question is that in the purport it is mentioned that Swayambhuva Manu wanted his grandson as a son because he knew that that child would be an incarnation of the Lord. So why did he deprive his daughter of that opportunity of having the Supreme Lord as her son? Well, that's something that I cannot answer. It's only that we can say this is a transcendental arrangement, because then eventually later they will be married. You see, they will have a daughter, if I remember right. I didn't get it with such a hurry. I have not had time to really go through, refresh my memory, but if I remember right, they had a daughter, that is Prajapati Ruchi and Akuti, who was an incarnation of Lakshmi Devi. And then she was married to Yajna.
Akuti gave birth to Yajna as well as
Lakshmi.
Dakshina
was an incarnation of...
Both they married.
Yes, they both married. So therefore, that arrangement needed some separation. You may ask, how come they were brothers and sisters, they got married? Well, in the beginning, everybody was like that. Because they were all children of Brahma. Everyone comes from Brahma. So if you look at it, ultimately we are all related. Right? Genetically, ultimately we all come from Brahma, not just humans. All the 8.4 million species of life, we are brothers and sisters. From that point of view. So that was the beginning. So there had to be some intermarriage within the family at that time, because there was no way the progeny would happen later. Okay? Yes?
How do the wise brahmanas know which lower dharmas to sacrifice for higher dharma?
How would the brahmanas know which lower dharma to sacrifice or which higher dharma? That is why they are brahmanas. That is the wisdom. That's why they were wise. They could distinguish, understand. The sense of discrimination was very strong. So one has to have a thorough grasp of dharma in all its facets to understand what to do when. So especially when it's a question of higher dharma, then we should know what is higher, what is lower, and when we can dispense with the lower and take the higher. Because life is always full of choices. Like we've seen already a couple of examples in the talk today. And we have to make a choice. So we all have to do that, actually. More often than we realize, we have to make these choices of dharma very often in life. Okay? Any one final question? Yes.
My question may find a bit funny.
Sorry?
My question may find it a bit funny. Mm-hmm. But my question is, we are here on the material world because we wanted to enjoy separate from Krishna and all these things. And on the other side, we are saying that we are for Prajapatis, and Prajapati's duty was to populate the human being, human life. So my question is, because those souls who were with Krishna and they wanted to enjoy themselves, that's why Prajapatis were made, to bring them on the material world.
Okay, the question is that the Prajapati's duty is to create progeny, to populate the universe. So is it because all the souls wanted to enjoy separate from Krishna that the Prajapatis have this function? In a sense, yes. You see, when the universe is destroyed, then the souls who have not gone back to Godhead, and most of the souls in the material world will be like that, then they stay with Mahavishnu. And at the time of the next creation, then through Mahavishnu's glance, they come back into the material creation and they get certain appropriate bodies and planets to stay on. But in order to bring them forth into this material world in appropriate bodies, you need the Prajapatis who are progenitors, who will then procreate, and then these souls who are looking for appropriate bodies in this material world will get the suitable kind of bodies. So these souls are already there in the material world. Then they move through the cycle of birth and death all through the material creation. And if they go back to Godhead, then they become free. If they don't, then they again at the end of the whole creation will go back to Mahavishnu. And then again the cycle repeats through the Prajapatis. It goes on. That is how the system happens. Okay, so we'll stop here, I think. Yes, one final question.
Where did Shukadeva Goswami speak to the sages?
Where did he speak?
Where did Shukadeva Goswami speak to the sages?
Where did Shukadeva Goswami speak to King Parikshit and the sages? It is a place that is near the bank of the Ganga. Not far from Delhi.
What is it called?
It's called Shukatal. And when you go there, maybe you can visit that place. It's a nice holy place where Shukadev Goswami is said to have spoken the Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay. Sorry? It's towards the place called Meerut. It's a little further beyond. So I would say about 2 to 3 hours. I mean, once you cross, of course, it can take you 2 to 3 hours to get out of Delhi, but outside of Delhi, you know, another 2-3 hours, I guess. Kilometers, I don't quite know, but in India, we usually calculate in terms of time because kilometers, sorry? Illusory, yeah, because kilometers, you know, the traffic and the roads and everything, it's just... I can't say, I don't remember. I would say more than that. Haridwar and Meerut and Haridwar, yes. So I guess a couple of 100 kilometers, maybe. 150, 200 kilometers, something like that. So the next time you go there, if you have time, you can try to visit. I'm sure the devotees in Delhi would be happy to facilitate. Okay, thank you very much. We're quite late today. I apologize once again for having come late. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai,
Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki
jai,
Gaur Premanande
Hare,
Hare Krishna.
Hare.